listening to the only daily talk show in North America covering the world of football. This is World Football Daily.
Yes, 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 yes! It hits the back of the net! Oh my goodness me!
The world's game.
Oh, you're beautiful! What a headshot! What a head!
Our religion.
Brilliant goal! What an equalizer!
Our passion.
Go, go, USA! Oh, it's incredible! You could not write a script like this!
World Football Daily serves up the best football talk 5 days a week.
Oh! You will never, ever see a game quite like this! Unbelievable!
Super City and its old show Shexy, as Ruud Gullit would say. Manchester City put five past Blackburn Rovers last night in FA Cup replay action. They are the dominant force in English football, and Aguero taking just 49 seconds to get back on the score sheet in his return to the City side. AC Milan finally get a win in the Coppa Italia. It had to come at some time. Milan with a 3-1 victory last night against Minos Spezia, as Napoli controversially get past Atalanta. And there's rumbles around Neymar once again. The amounts of money that were given to his father in the Brazilian's £47 million transfer to Barcelona being investigated by Spanish prosecutors. We will keep up to date on that and dive into that story a little deeper today here on World Football Daily. Welcome to the show. I'm Oliver the Juice Wilson here on Thursday's edition of World Football Daily, bringing you all the great sporting news and views from around world football. Joining us today is a man who pretty much epitomises what we try to do here at World Football Daily and bring you some of the best guests and the best talk about global football. Andy Brassel will be joining us here to take us through a little bit of Portugal and Germany. It may be off-season at the moment in Germany, but there's still plenty to talk about in terms of the transfer window and Portuguese football as well. Matic rejoining Chelsea for a hefty sum. We'll break down the pros and cons of that move and any other movers and shakers coming out of Portugal. Later on in the show, Rafa will be joining me as well. There's two things I want to touch on here on the intro to the show here on World Football Daily. I like to think this is like my kind of six-minute little ramble, and I get to rant about some stuff, but I'm not ranting too much today. There's one little rant that I've got. But I want to start off on a positive note. I was watching the some ESPN 30 for 30s. They keep showing all the new ones here in the UK, which is just bliss for myself, because I'll happily sit down and watch a documentary on foot or on any sport, pretty much as long as it's engaging enough in the first 15 minutes, I'll get hooked onto it, and you won't be able to get rid of me on it. So I've been watching all of these, and it just got me thinking. There's not many soccer ones on the roster of the ESPN 30 for 30 collection. So my thought is, and I want to ask Andy this, I'll let you know my thoughts and what I want to see made as well, but I want to ask you guys the question first and foremost. What soccer stories do you want to see get made on ESPN, by ESPN 30 for 30, or by a kind of proper documentary crew in general? What soccer sports stories do you want to see get made? I mean, there are so many great tales from world football over the years, down through the ages, and telling it either through the fans, through the players that were there, through the journalists. Either way, there are some incredible stories that could be put into an hour and a half and make an enthralling documentary about the journeys, either to success or failure in world football. I mean, even something like, you know, Portsmouth or Rangers going into administration or something like that could make a very, very interesting story, getting all the kind of components and elements and key figures in those stories to sit down in a room and talk about the decisions that led to the problems at those clubs, and of course the success stories as well. I'll let you know the one that I want to see get made later on in the show. I'll be asking Andy Brassel the same thing, as I say. But remember, show at worldfootballdaily.com, at WFootballDaily on Twitter, 310-909-8483, and the Facebook page as well is where you can get in contact with us and tell us your sports story that you want to see get made. It could even be something from your home team, from your local club, something like that. You know, I'd love to. I would love to see, actually, the story of my first time, the first season I ever played 11-a-side football in. We used to play kind of 6-7-a-side, and then our team, when we got old enough, were allowed to play 11-a-side. So the 2 6- and 7-a-side teams joined together to create one 11-a-side team plus a handful of substitutes. And the very first season, in the qualifiers for the leagues, basically you played 4 qualifiers with teams from your local area, and if you won all your games, you were likely to go in the local top league. We lost all of our qualifiers, went down into the very bottom league of our local area. Now, we weren't a bad side, we were a very good side, and there were a couple of teams that struggled in the qualifiers that were actually very good. There was one team that we played who we were 5-0 up against at half time, so the defenders got to go up front and the attackers got to go and play at the back. And I have to say, I was just playing across the back for any position, really, right, left, centre back, you name it, I could do it. And I got moved up front for the second half, bagged 5 goals myself, and we won 17-0. And that team actually folded after that crushing defeat. I felt very bad about that we beat them so badly that they ended up folding as a team. But that season, in that very first year, there was one other team, a local side, and it was us against them for the top of the table position to win the league on the final day of the season. And we were playing a team called William Morris, and I remember it very well indeed, and it was a proper mud bowl. I mean, the ball, there was one scene which both me and a few friends who played in that remember, of the ball being stuck in the mud and in our penalty area at a corner, and we were just hacking away at it to try and get rid of it, and it was going nowhere. And you know, their attackers were trying to hit it, and it would move about 4 yards forward and then stop in the mud. It was just a mud bowl. Goal line scrambles galore in that game at both ends of the pitch. We ended up winning 2-0, and that win gave us, we were all kind of getting our dads to try and ring up and find out on the phone what the other scores were from around the league, and we all found out that we'd won the league on the last day of the season. We were so ecstatic. And then the following year, we actually won the league with the last kick of the season. Our left winger picked the ball up at the halfway, and I made a mazy little run in the dying seconds of the last game of the season, smashed the ball into the far top corner. We got 3 points and won the league that day. And the euphoria, even as like a, you know, 13-year-old kid or something like that, I'd love to see them make an ESPN 30 for 30 about that. It was pretty awesome. But unlikely, I think, the 13-year-old 11-a-side game, that it's going to be made into an ESPN documentary, that's for sure. But let us know the ones that you'd like, the stories you'd like told. Maybe it is from your local football team. There is plenty to talk about here on World Football Daily today, and we will leave some of the best till last. But I do want to get into what's happening at Southampton, because in the last few hours, it's become a very crazy situation going down at St Mary's. The Saints, who are pretty much the success story of any club in English football right about now, going down, pulling themselves back up from League One to get back into the Premier League. They're bringing through some great talent from England. Adam Lallana, of course, Lambert, and his England debut coming at the ripe old age of 30. And of course, somebody like Luke Shaw as well is coming through, and hotly devoured talent looking to maybe move in the next few years or so to one of the bigger clubs in England, or even could go elsewhere around the world as well. Who knows? But a real success story for English football, and for bringing through young quality. Suddenly, the whole club has gone into disarray in the last few hours, because it looks like, Nicola Cortesi has quit the club after falling out with the club's owner, Caterina Lieber. Now, to break this down very briefly in very kind of layman's terms, so to speak, the club was bought in 2009 by Marcus Lieber, who basically appointed Nicola Cortesi as to control the club and to run the day-to-day running of Southampton Football Club. Now, Cortesi, of course, is the man that fell out with the fans so emphatically when he got rid of Nigel Atkins and brought in Pochettino. And suddenly, when that started to go well, the fans kind of forgave him for that, because, hey, it's all running smoothly, it's no worries at all. And Cortesi and Pochettino obviously got on and get on very well indeed. Now, though, Marcus Lieber's daughter, Caterina Lieber, is looking to get more and more heavily involved in the running of the club as a business and as a football team. Now, she has no history of running a football club in any way, shape or form, and Cortesi and her have been at loggerheads in the last few months or so behind the scenes at Southampton. It's got to a point where Cortesi has quit. Now, Pochettino, who was hired by Cortesi, and gets on very well with him, is threatening to leave as well over Cortesi's departure from the club. And this would be a disaster, because you then have a football club with an executive owner who's getting more involved, that's never run a football club before, and you would have lost your manager, who has helped you go from being that side that's battling for Premier League survival to now possibly being on the verge of making a top half finish, and even in the next year or so pushing on for Europa League spots. It's still not out of the realms of possibilities. And it sums up the business against football kind of style of Premier League football at the moment. But disaster is on the brink if Pochettino does leave. Already Cortesi gone and quitting the club. And Cortesi and Pochettino talking last night. Cortesi apparently had to calm down Pochettino and beg him not to leave the club as well, because Cortesi still wants to see Southampton do well. There are also fears that Caterina Lieber might even sell the club on as well, which wouldn't be great for Southampton fans. The insecurity that sort of move brings to a club, to the players, the atmosphere it would bring around that club, and ninth place at the moment in the Premier League table, and it would be a disaster to kind of knock them off their pedestal. Is this business interfering with football too much? Let us know your thoughts. Show up worldfootballdaily.com and at WFootballDaily on Twitter. We're going to move away from the Premier League and hope that things go all right down at Southampton. But in the meantime, we're going to have to step away and look at some worldwide football across Europe at the moment. The Coppa del Rey, the Coppa Italia continuing. And of course, the transfer window brings new stories to our ears every single day. I'm delighted to say a man who's joining us here on World Football Daily to take us through some of those is a man that we always enjoy having on the show. His first appearance of 2014, and we're very glad to welcome him back. Of course, it's the big bad Brass, Mr. Andy Brassel, joining us here on World Football Daily. Andy, man, a pleasure to have you back here in 2014. Hope you had a very good new year and a bit of downtime as well over Christmas, mate. How are you?
I did. That is the way of the European leagues. And a happy new year to you too.
Well, it must be nice that you kind of, especially anybody covering Germany, I always get quite jealous of over Christmas, because they have this month off. Sure, there's friendlies and whatnot, but they do have a very large chunk of downtime before getting back into the hectic schedule again. Whereas anybody who's covering English football is kind of almost at their wit's end over Christmas, because they're trying to do everything with the family, and then they're also having to cover all the football as well. It must be a nightmare for them.
You never know what to say to people. You say have a good holiday a couple of days before Christmas, and they sort of look daggers at you.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm getting up at 7 a.m. on Boxing Day. Thank you. Yeah, cheers. Let's talk actually. A quick question about the kind of Christmas break, because everybody, a lot of people say they want to see that coming into English football, having, you know, less fixtures and a little bit more of a rest over the Christmas and New Year period. But considering that we see so many of these clubs going off and playing, you know, big friendlies over in Doha, out in Dubai, kind of raking the money from that, would an international would a Christmas break, sorry, for England, especially for the clubs that are involved in things like Champions League football already, would it actually become a break? Because surely they'd do what teams like PSG, Real Madrid are doing and go off and play each other in these friendly games and have all these training camps out in Asia, kind of to build up the kind of marketability of the clubs, that a break wouldn't really take place.
Well, it's clear that would happen with Premier League clubs, but I think the players getting a few days off, just completely away from everything. But like you know, even in France, which has the shortest winter break, they have a week, and you know that was the same for PSG, even though they went to Doha. I think that's really important, especially in a World Cup year. I think it's not just the physical benefits, but the mental benefits. You know, players being able to spend time with their families at Christmas and just like disconnect and come back mentally refreshed. I think that's very, very important. And I think as well, you know, people talk a lot about tradition and how you couldn't do away with Boxing Day fixtures and stuff. You don't need to do away with Boxing Day fixtures. You know, you look at Belgium and Turkey, they play on the 26th, 27th, 28th, and then they have a couple of weeks off. So, you know, that is a way you could do it. And I think especially in recent years, you're getting more extreme weather conditions in the UK that cause a lot of postponements. And, you know, I think that can be a real difficulty, because, of course, even at Premier League grounds where you have undersoil heating, fantastic pitches, it's more a question of public safety. You know, icy walkways around the stadium, public transport not working properly. You've had a game called off at Arsenal when the pitch is perfect before, for those very sort of reasons. Mm. So I think it would be all round beneficial for everyone. Say if you had 3 weeks off from, call it a couple of days from the end of January. You know, if a tour wants to go in there, I still think it's a case of mental recharging. If you do a mini tour to the Middle East, even though it would probably be better if they just stayed at home and trained with some intensity, because the matches aren't quite as high octane as they would be if you were playing league fixtures, and the players get to bond in a camp abroad. I suppose a lot of people would look at the fact that Premier League clubs do have a sort of checkered record of behaviour on tour, so perhaps that would be something to look at. I think it would be an inevitable part of any winter break, but that doesn't mean it's an idea we should completely write off.
Now, Andy, before we get into the depths of European transfer windows and obviously there's plenty of possible moves coming up and Matic's move back to Chelsea as well, I definitely want to talk to you about. Before we get into that, I've been rambling on already in the show about these ESPN 30 for 30 documentaries that I'm sure many of our listeners are aware of. They're beautiful inside stories into some of the greatest sporting stories throughout history. In football, because there aren't many of them about football, a lot of them are around basketball, baseball, etc. What would be the football story that you would like to see turned into maybe like an hour and a half documentary about the game? What kind of team, what player, what would it be focused around, do you think, Andy?
There are a few that spring to mind. I certainly think a look into Corsican football is something I wrote for the first Blizzard, and I think the Blizzard can provide loads of templates for this sort of thing, because it's long form stuff that's not really necessarily driven by a news agenda, just stuff that we think would be interesting and like to talk about, and loads of people have got on board with that, and it's been brilliant. Jonathan Wilson's done an incredible job with it, so I think Corsica is something that's always been a pet interest of mine, just because of the deeply political undercurrent to the football there and the incredibly volatile nature of it. But the match that I've always loved more than most since I've been doing the job has been the Sevilla derby between Betis and Sevilla, and that I would love to see something on that, because it's something that people say it's no big deal in the days coming up towards the game, but when you're there on the day and on the night, it's absolutely explosive. And to have a city of that size, about 400,000, with two teams that can get crowds of 50,000 in, is absolutely extraordinary. I suppose in one way it'd be like if Newcastle and Sunderland played in the same city.
It's obviously actually, Andy, you've got the connections down at BT. You could they're putting together these BT sports stories and whatnot. I'm sure that would be a viable pitch. I mean, it is a wonderfully unique derby, that, as you say, in terms of the size of the city. I mean, it's not even just like taking Sunderland and Newcastle, putting them in the same city. You'd then have to reduce probably the population of Newcastle by about 30% or so to then get it down to those two teams and the intensity of that rivalry. I think for me personally, I'd go with the AC Milan Barcelona 4-0 European Cup final, and how Milan were such underdogs going into that game and then just tore them apart. I'd love to see and hear about the kind of backstage kind of stories that came out, what Milan thought going into that game against kind of Stoichkov without two of their best defenders. I digress though. We'll get into that a little bit later on the show and see what Rafa says as well. Let's get into some of the transfer stories coming out from at the January transfer window at the moment, Andy, and the return of Matic back to Chelsea from Benfica. Is this a smart move from Chelsea? We've seen it a couple of times with Premier League clubs getting rid of somebody and then bringing them back for a vast amount more money. And Matic's obviously part of that deal that helped to bring David Luiz across to Benfica. What do you make? Do you think he's ready now for Premier League football?
I do. He's been tremendous in the last 18 months. Benfica's best player, I think. I was lucky enough to be at the Estadio de Luz for Benfica Porto on Sunday, and it was his last game, of course. And there'd been talk beforehand that he might not play the game because he was scared of getting an injury if he played. And I tend to think that was agent talk rather than the player himself. he's always been someone who's worked very hard for the team, very committed, and it's very difficult to imagine him refusing to play or anything like that. And he was so committed on the day. He was the best player on the pitch by a mile, and he showed exactly why Chelsea wanted him so much, and so many other clubs wanted him so much. I think Chelsea were prodded into action by the interest of so many others, and so many other direct competitors, I think, on the English and European stage, because you know, Bayern Munich had had a little look recently, because he's not just very strong defensively, the great tackler, and really good in the air, but he's someone who can bring the ball forward. He can dribble, he can pass the ball, and you know, I think that's become very, very important in a midfielder with mainly defensive characteristics nowadays, that they can actually do something on the ball. It's a need that Chelsea have had for a while. It's a need that Chelsea have had for a year and a half, which is why people have looked at Matic and specifically their decision to let him go, and wondered, did they do the right thing? I tend to think it's a move that actually works out pretty well for everyone, because I think, you know, people can criticise Chelsea's ability to bring players through the ranks, and, you know, I think that's a different issue to this, because there's no one who thought that Matic would go on to become the player that he has become. And I think even in his first year at Benfica, everyone was really sort of thinking, you know, here's a guy who can do a job for the squad. But for the first year and a half, no one saw a player who was going to, you know, lead the team forward or anything like that. And it was just really through necessity when they sold Axel Witsel to Zenit St. Petersburg and Javi Garcia, of course, to Manchester City in a couple of days, that he had to come in and do a job, and he became a regular really overnight. And he was fantastic. You know, they didn't miss Witsel or Javi Garcia last season, which is, I think, says all you need to know. He's grown an enormous amount. He's incredibly confident. But I think for anyone to foresee that was going to happen, I think it's ridiculous to criticise Chelsea and say, oh, well, why did you let him go? They had no idea. And I think, you know, it's a small price to pay to have had him go out and get that experience of, you know, playing in these big European matches, of playing in a huge rivalry, you know, every time, not just Benfica and Porto play, but every time Benfica play is a big deal. You can't afford to drop a single point. So competitive has been the battle between those two at the top of the league in the last couple of years. He deserved more trophies in his time in Lisbon. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And that they should have been champions last year. They should have been champions the year before. But nevertheless, I think the Benfica fans will have very, very positive memories of him. And he got a terrific hand before the game and when he went off at the end.
It's not a bad way for him to depart with a 2-0 win over Porto in that fantastic game against Benfica in the Estadio de Luz. But for Benfica now, there's got to be, you mentioned already some of the names that have departed from that similar position that Matic now leaves vacant at Benfica. Who comes in to replace in such an important role, in such an important season, with Sporting Lisbon throwing their name in the hat as well in for the title race?
Well, it's a very difficult question, and I think, like, if I had to judge the title race on the evidence of last weekend, you'd think if Porto keep on the road that they are, they've got absolutely no chance of winning the league. But one Portuguese journalist, I'm afraid I can't remember who it is off the top of my head, said best transfer business that might happen for Porto and Sporting in this winter is the departures from Benfica. Everyone knows they're short of money. They've sold Matic for a little bit less than they've preferred to, that they would have sold him last summer, and Jorge Jesus, the coach, said, you know, he's too good, I just can't hold on to him. But they were asking too much for him, and for that reason they didn't get to complete a deal. Now not qualifying for the Champions League, having spent a lot elsewhere in the club on English Premier League rights, they need cash flow, and so Garay will probably follow him out the door. I think you're looking at probably Stephen Vitoria to come up from the B team. He was at Estoril last season to replace a very, very good centre back. But, you know, not much, like, top flight football, not any top flight football really this season. In midfield, I think it's more a case of rejigging the balance. Maybe Enzo Perez, who's been brilliant really since he's come back to Benfica from that loan spell in Argentina, in a central role rather than as a winger. He's someone who will be relied on even more. It's something he can cope with. Ideally, they'd like to get someone in, but whether they'll actually be able to spend any money this month. I feel sorry for Jorge Jesus. He's done financially brilliantly for the club. It's not just the fact that he won some trophies and played some great football. It's the fact that he's managed to make players augment in value tremendously. I think Fabio Quintao is an example. Matic is another one, of course. So he's done great business, and you know, let's hope he gets a few euros to spend in this window. I'm not convinced he will, though.
There's talk as well of departures from Porto from a similar position to Matic as well. Gonzalez, Fernando have both been linked to moves away from Porto. I mean, those could also be very damaging in those central midfield roles for Porto come the second half of the season, should they lose one or both of them.
My feeling is that won't happen, though. It looks like Fernando might sign a new contract in order to protect his value for Porto. It won't stop him maybe leaving in the summer or whatever, but that seems to be fairly close, according to his agents. Lucho Gonzalez is out of contract at the end of the season, but he said he's not going to even talk about his contract until the end of the season. He wants to concentrate on winning the league and going from there. And I think, you know, with the bond he has with Porto, you can really believe him when he says that. For them, it's not about buying or selling players. They've got a very capable squad. I think it's very unlikely they're going to lose anyone. It's about getting a plan, about getting a best 11. That's what they don't have at the moment. Paulo Fonseca's changed shape. He's changed personnel. And they've looked pretty unconvincing against all really but the weakest opposition. It was the first time in 20 Champions League group campaigns that have not won a single home match, which, you know, they're in a very, very clement group to qualify from. And quite frankly, how Zenit St. Petersburg got out of that is absolutely astonishing. So, you know, there's work to do, but there's work to do with the existing players, because I really think they'll hang on to Fonseca, whether he's the right man for the job. Personally, I think probably not, but they're very unlikely to fire him mid-season. So he's got a big challenge over the next 3 or 4 months.
Let's jump across just very briefly, Andy, because I know we're taking up too much of your time already today on the on World Football Daily, but I do want to...
I'm talking too long, one of the...
Well, you know, I didn't want to say... Never, Andy, never. I do want to talk about Schalke, because in Germany, everybody's... Dortmund, Bayern, there's been the talk about Lewandowski and then who Dortmund can bring in to replace him next season, but Schalke are the ones that are making plenty of headlines, especially around the future of Julian Draxler. Now, the club has said that there have been no bids from Arsenal, but for Draxler to leave, would this be the wrong time, do you think, for the 20-year-old to be departing from Germany, where he has got a very stable system around him that knows how to play to his advantages?
I think it would be a bad time to move, but I think he knows that. He's very intelligent. He's very mature for his age. And he's someone who shows that he will flourish when he moves abroad, as I'm pretty much sure he will, if not at the end of this season, at the end of the one after. Because, you know, he's been able to step up and seize responsibility at a club like Schalke, which you can't emphasise enough. The pressure that's on players there, and you need to be a strong character to deal with it. And he's somebody who has done. I think especially before the arrival of Kevin Prince-Boateng, an incredible amount of responsibility was falling onto him, and he dealt with it. He got them in the Champions League almost single-handedly when they played terribly over two legs against Park. So I think, you know, it's his sort of season of consecration at Schalke, really, and he wants to see that out. Of course, he's been carrying a little injury as well, although he will be ready for the restart on the 24th. I think all parties know it makes better sense for him to stay. Unless he's forced out the door, he will do. But I can foresee a move after that, because, you know, he's someone who deserves to be playing in the best competitions and for trophies all the time.
And the other potential move into the Bundesliga, the return of Kevin De Bruyne, potentially moving to Wolfsburg, leaving Chelsea. This is a really sad story for somebody who's been a wonderful player, finally given an opportunity at Chelsea after being recalled back from his loan spell, and they seem to be shipping him out straight away. Is it De Bruyne who's not good enough, or is it just Chelsea not knowing how to handle and to play this player correctly? Because he's succeeded so far throughout his career when he's not been in the blue of Chelsea.
Exactly, Ollie. I'd go with the latter. I think they really missed the trick here. Obviously, they're getting a great opportunity to make a lot of money out of him, and that goes to offsetting any loss, as you might call it, on Matic. But I don't think that's really the point. I mean, you know, we've been talking all season about how Chelsea have had problems with their strikers. I think they've missed a trick in not using either De Bruyne or Eden Hazard in that role, because they've both played a sort of centre forward or sort of false nine position. Hazard with Lille when he scored an absolute truckload of goals, De Bruyne when he was at Werder Bremen. So, you know, I think maybe they could have been a little bit more adventurous with that. And I think really that's a sort of De Bruyne's situation with Chelsea in microcosm. They haven't dared to give him more of a go. Of course, we know they've got enormous talent there, but it must have really deflated him when he saw them sign Willian, who again has been excellent in recent weeks. You know, there's no criticising him, but it's a great shame for De Bruyne. But I'm sure he'll flourish at Wolfsburg. I think it's an extraordinary amount of money. That, don't get me wrong, it's very, very expensive. But, you know, of all clubs, Wolfsburg can take the hit. And it'd be really interesting to see how they use him, whether they use him in the 10. I tend to think he's better in a central role, even though he cut his teeth in Belgium as a winger. So maybe eventually we're looking at some sort of replacement for Diego. Max Arnold, I think the teenager, will probably continue to flourish in a wide position. But there are a few question marks there at Wolfsburg, because we don't know if Ivica Olic will extend his deal as well, which is going to be out at the end of the season. I'm sure Diego will be on his way, and Atletico Madrid, a return there wouldn't surprise me. De Bruyne's going to get games, and that's really, really important, because he's someone who deserves to be in the mix for the 11 for Belgium when they start that World Cup campaign.
If he did move, I mean, that midfield, Ivan Perisic, Diego, and of course De Bruyne, if he joined them, would that boost them into potentially being, we've seen Dortmund slide recently and they're only 2 points off those Champions League spots, would that tip them into a very strong possibility of being in the Champions League for next year, Wolfsburg?
I think that's exactly what they're trying to do, Ollie. I don't think there's any doubt about that. They've stabilised nicely under Dieter Hecking. I think they've been pretty strong at grinding out results over the last couple of months. I'm never completely convinced by them. But, you know, they're starting to at last, you know, be able to grind out results and not be so porous, which has been their problem ever since they won the title. Getting the lid back on that defensively, they've been very unstable. They've got some important players in there now who are steady, who can lead them forward. They always had a great goalkeeper in Diego Benaglio, but now I think they've got a great centre back in Robin Knocker as well. And you know, they're quality players wherever you look all over the pitch, and they're looking to improve. I think the fourth spot is definitely up for grabs. I can see Dortmund getting back up into second place. They've got players coming back. Of course, we've still got more to see from Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. Who knows, maybe he'll evolve in a central position in time, having been used on the wings. You know, there's been talk of him maybe being an eventual Lewandowski replacement, although I'd be surprised if they didn't buy a centre-forward in summer. But I think fourth and maybe third, depending on how Bayer Leverkusen get on, because of course they had a couple of dodgy results before we went into the break. If they can recover and get back on track, I don't think that many people will be surprised. But you know, it's a sort of watershed for them, because Sidney Sam has already signed for Schalke next season. You know, you have to wonder where they're going to go from there. Mönchengladbach would still be my favourites for fourth. I don't think there's any doubt about that. They're just so good to watch coming forward, and I think, you know, they've coped with some horrible injuries in defence, and they've got over that. So I think they've got past the most difficult point they'll have this season. But Wolfsburg are really up for challenging them, and of course that draw between the pair just before Christmas just keeps it bubbling nicely. So if that was still a storyline become middle of April, I think that would be very exciting indeed.
And I think it also makes the opening game back from the break for the Bundesliga of Gladbach at home against Bayern Munich even more tantalising as well, with Gladbach, as I say, jumping up into third place in the Bundesliga table above Dortmund before that break. Andy, mate, it's been an absolute pleasure as always to have a chat with you about all things European football, and we will get back in touch with you, I'm sure, in the next few weeks to get you back on World Football Daily and providing us with your just overwhelming knowledge on all things football, mate. We always appreciate you taking the time out.
sorry for celebrating my return from a sore throat so emphatically. speaking to you soon.
It's not a problem, mate. Always a pleasure, never a chore, as Christian Hennage would say, mate. Thanks so much, and we'll catch up with you very soon indeed, man.
Cheers.
Take care. Andy Brassel there joining us here on World Football Daily, taking us through some of the transfer stories out of Portugal and the Bundesliga today. The Bundesliga, of course, still off on its break, returns on the 24th of January. Those lazy, lazy Germans not getting back to football just yet. But a very interesting idea of Kevin De Bruyne moving back to Wolfsburg. And it's been a shame because there's so much talk about his potential. Of course, he had great periods at Werder Bremen, and of course Genk as well, on loan from Chelsea after joining in 2012. Returned to Genk for the half year, had a great year last year, as I say, at Werder Bremen, and a big opportunity I think missed for Chelsea with a fantastic one of those young Belgium talents. Only 22 still, Kevin De Bruyne, and still plenty to show us in world football. Rafa, man, I got to ask you, because I asked Andy about it. By the way, Rafa, good to speak to you today.
Yes, it's quite a pleasure to talk to you too, man.
He's here. Yada yada yada.
I'm here.
Yada.
Yeah, let's get
into it. I asked Andy this, of course, and what do you think about the return possibly of Kevin De Bruyne back to German football, where he excelled, obviously, at Werder Bremen. I was quite surprised. Andy kind of almost backed Chelsea in bringing in Matic back, because it's cost them a lot of money. You know, Matic went with that $25 million for David Luiz, and now coming back for a hefty sum, $21 million or so, from Benfica. But it means De Bruyne looks like he's going to be on his way out. What a waste of talent. Really? What an absolute waste of talent from Chelsea's point of view with Kevin.
I don't know, Juice, because from what I'm reading.
Oh, so you're gonna go against myself and Andy. You're going against Brassel here, Raf.
And Andy Brassel. Only because of this. According to the reports that I'm reading, Juice, I'm seeing a flip of about, well, basically, Kevin De Bruyne going for $26 million. Now,
that's not gonna.
Yeah. You say it's not going to happen?
Not for $26 million. That's extortion.
Okay. Well, fair enough. Would you agree that's probably going to happen for over $10 million?
Yeah. Well, what I've read is going to be around about $18 million for De Bruyne to go to Werder.
So they're going to make about $7.5 million because they bought him for $10.5 million about 2 years ago. Now, considering the fact that he's hardly played any real time in the first team,
he's never been
Chelsea,
given the chance.
So somehow he just appreciated in value $7.5 million
because they've got to make money back after splashing out so much money on Matip and giving away Matic and $25 million in the first place for David Luiz. If you think about it, Chelsea have got rid of somebody and paid $25 million to bring in somebody else. Then they brought him back for $21 million. So they've almost bought one player for about $40 million rather than buying two players. As you look at it, so David Luiz arguably has cost Chelsea now $40 million, and they need to make some of that money back. I mean, obviously Chelsea can afford to take the hit and whatnot. It's one of the wealthiest clubs in the world, but they still need to financial fair play and all that. Need to pull their socks out a bit. The other thing I wanted to ask is what I asked Andy straight at the beginning of that little chat. Like I said, I was rambling on a bit about the ESPN 30 for 30s, and I'm not going to lie, I was watching the one about North Carolina State Wolfpack and their NCAA championship win in 1983 under the great Jim Valvano. Just a wonderful story, and told so well through the players' eyes themselves, and wonderful documentary. And I've been watching that. I watched the one about the New York Islanders takeover and all that. What football story, Raf? I mean, actually, here's the one I reckon that you should want to happen before. I'm going to give your answer for you here. Because surely you want an ESPN 30 for 30 to come out in about 5 years' time when Rangers have reclaimed the Scottish Premier League for the first time since their fall. And you want to go up to Glasgow and film Rangers' plight through the eyes of the fans that have stuck with them and travelled all to all those Scottish lower league games and whatnot and back up. Surely that's like, that would be the best ESPN 30 for 30 for you. What would be the football story you'd want told in one of those ESPN documentaries?
Well, you're damn right in the sense that I'd love to see Rangers kind of justified through that sort of documentary. But, there's a couple things I'd like to kind of see. I'd like to, maybe that deep run that the U.S. made when we beat Portugal and ended up in like the quarterfinals of the South Korea.
That doesn't have a happy story ending.
But it was around that time that I'd say, you know, U.S. soccer was starting to be taken a little more seriously. We weren't just mugs then. You know, we weren't kind of
mugs.
We weren't mugs. We were kind of a threat. We obviously upset some people, and we really kind of came to light. There was a lot of players in that team that really became big icons in U.S. soccer. One especially being Landon Donovan, and then you could kind of follow that through to his big Algeria goal. You know. In the next World Cup and what he's done in the following World Cups and then how he's really impacted U.S. soccer and stuff like that. I think that'd be a really good one. Juice, I'm not sure if you know this yet, but and I'm not sure if this is probably why you bring this up, but ESPN is doing a whole kind of football-related or soccer-related 30 for 30 series. I think it's like a series of 7 or 8.
Wow, I did not know this. This is good timing to have brought this up.
I'm not exactly sure how many there are, but it's going to be going on sometime soon, heading into the World Cup, and it's kind of like a build-up for ESPN. And I'm really,
very
really looking
cool.
forward to it because it is kind of like, do you remember you were here for the Euros, right?
Yeah.
When the Euros were going on, ESPN was kind of doing sort of 30 for 30s. Like they did specials on the Ukraine and, football under the Soviet rule and stuff like that. And it was just some really interesting stories. And it kind of brings you a connection to those host nations when they did that. So I'm assuming that's going to be kind of the same thing. I think it'll also probably highlight, again, I don't have that press release or that story in front of me, Juice, but I do know that they are looking to kind of celebrate football and kind of
bring that
flavor, that Brazilian flavor and style, and really try to connect that U.S. audience and market as we head into the World Cup.
I've already said on the show today that, you know, if anybody needs me to make this documentary and wants to pay for me to make the documentary about the 1994 AC Milan Champions League winning side that battered Barca 4-0 in the Champions League final, the underdogs that were missing Costa Curta and Baresi, no Lentini or Van Basten through injury, and yet still battered the heavily favoured Barca. I would be more than happy to tell that story through the players' eyes and through the fans' eyes, and to talk about what went on in the during that Champions League kind of run for AC Milan and the build-up to that final as they went into it as underdogs against Barca. If anybody from ESPN is listening, I'm more than happy to make that. If you help fund me the money, that's all I need, just a little bit of cash, more than happy to do so. And I'm sure we could I could get someone like Chris Folks to give me a hand with it as well.
Okay.
in terms of the Italian translation.
Here's the actual kind of press release going on. It's a new film series, 30 for 30 soccer stories surrounding the 2014 World Cup on ESPN. It will premiere a new series in April, so not 2 months from now.
I can't make this thing in two months. I might have to be like, yeah, give me 4 years. Next World Cup,
potentially a post World Cup documentary,
Russia,
from Juice.
It'll be Russia World Cup build up. That's what we'll do it for.
Gotcha. So, in addition, a collection of 10 vignettes about Brazil's rich soccer culture will feature throughout ESPN's FIFA World Cup programming.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, they're doing a lot of stuff. Here are some of the actual
titles.
Stories. Here's a story.
Here we go.
Right off the bat, Hillsborough. Wow.
Hey, that's not a
yeah. That's one way to start off. White, Blue, and White, directed by Camilo Antonellini. This is about the Argentinian players. These are the Argentinian exports in England's top flight. So you're Ozzy Ardiles, Ricky Villa, players like that. Ooh, Garincha, Crippled Angel, is yet another story. Barbosa, the man who made all of Brazil cry. Ceasefire Massacre. Ooh, this is, what is this? This is some really good stuff.
I love how off script we are in this.
It was crazy timing that you brought this up because I recently just heard about this and I'm very, very excited. I'm super. Anytime U.S. media, especially sports media, get behind soccer, it's especially international soccer.
Well, that's
it. I'm not saying like international competition. I'm saying football from outside of the U.S. Not that I don't appreciate when MLS gets mentioned or the U.S. men's national team gets mentioned, but when we do kind of culturize Americans and introduce them and bring them kind of new and really top quality football, I think Americans can appreciate a good sport and it being played at the highest level, and this is only going to help it, man. Like this kind of support. But by the mainstream, sports media here in the U.S. is going to be amazing.
There are so many great stories in classic football, and the one thing that I've loved about these ESPN movies is how good they are at telling some of the best stories in American sport. There's so many of them are based around basketball, American football, ice hockey, baseball, etc. And there's been very few soccer ones, apart from the two Escobars is the one that I've seen that really stood out as a fantastic piece of work. And anybody should try and get a copy of that or DVR it or stream it illegally if you have to. It's a fantastic documentary about Pablo Escobar and his influence on Colombian football. We've talked about it plenty of times on World Football Daily before. But there are so many of those stories in football to talk about, and so many of the kind of hidden behind the doors, behind closed doors stories to kind of work out, edge out, and tell and introduce to people.
And I think a lot of these stories, the pageantry, for you and me especially, I think there's also a lot of stories out there that we've probably heard before. But we like to hear more, and we like to relive it and go through it again.
Well, you want to hear it from the people that were, rather than just being told it, you want to hear it from the people through their eyes as well. And I think the pageantry of gets put on these stories, because they're so heavily backed by ESPN, they're very good at kind of making sure they track down and get hold of all the right people to talk to in terms of telling these tales. That even Donald Trump obviously got involved in that USFL one, although he didn't sit around too long for that interview, that's for sure. Especially when they brought out that $1 check for him. But I think it would attract I think more people to the sport as well in America, because they'd see some of the great stories behind some of football's greatest moments, and I think that only does anything but to help build the bonds and to encourage people to get into it a little bit more. Right. I think these new ones coming out from ESPN, I'll have to have a check out of that list myself, and we will see just what they're covering, and I'm sure we'll get a good discussion about it later on in the week, or even next week, or at some point in the next few weeks here on World Football Daily. There's plenty to talk about in terms of transfer news and, of course, fixtures as well from last night and the very peculiar moment in Atalanta's clash against Napoli last night. Insigne's goal. I haven't actually seen the goal myself just yet, but it's causing a lot of problems. Here's the description that I've been reading over the last few hours or so, trying to work out what exactly happened with this. Basically, it's 1-0 between Napoli and Atalanta last night, and Napoli took the lead through Insigne. Gonzalo Higuain was offside, apparently, but the ball never actually reached him as it hit Cristiano Del Grosso in the back. The entire Atalanta defence basically kind of stopped and turned towards the linesman. The ball bounced right into Insigne's path, and he turns it into an empty net. Now, because it never reached Higuain, people kind of saying that the referee's saying that he didn't really interfere in play because the ball didn't get to him. He didn't have a chance to touch it or anything like that. But he obviously influenced the movement of the Atalanta defence. And arguably, you could argue the same way that Joe Hart was influenced by the one Newcastle player around him when Tiote scored the other day. And you just wonder if they're going to be reinterpreting the offside rule once again come the end of the season. Insigne's goal, though, giving them a 2-1 lead. Napoli, and they went on to beat Atalanta in the Coppa Italia last night.
Do you think Caillon is betting in well there at Napoli already? Or is that too...
No, he's. I think he's done okay this season. To be honest, Napoli, though, have been slightly underwhelming. I was expecting them to push Juventus all the way this year. And without Cavani, it's obviously not been the exact same aggressiveness in that side. Higuain has been an incredible player for them this year, no doubt about that. But I do think there's just a little bit more chemistry needed. Maybe another year and Napoli might be able to test Juventus, although if Juventus continue to strengthen their side, whether they're going to lose Paul Pogba or not. That was a hot topic of debate yesterday about Pogba. Is he going or not? Come the end of this season, I don't think he's going to go to Manchester United, that's for sure. But Jonathan Johnson yesterday telling us about that possible move to PSG, especially with Pogba's agent Raiola being heavily involved with a number of the players down at PSG. You could see that one maybe getting pushed through come the end of the summer. Verratti coming back, that would be no bad thing to for Juventus to have to deal with. Oh no, we get to have one of the best young kind of midfielders in Italian football right about now to replace one of the other best young midfielders in French football right about now. Oh, that's terrible for them. poor Juventus if that takes place. But no, I do think Callejon's done very well coming in and adjusted quickly, as have most of those players that Benitez has brought in, to be honest. They've all adjusted very quickly. I think it shows how good a manager Rafa Benitez has been at Napoli. You know, taking over from Walter Mazzarri was always going to be a difficult job. And what Mazzarri did there was he created a real force in Italian football. And Benitez kind of taking the reins and being asked to go and do something more with that, especially after losing, you know, their best player. It took a guy with big cojones to come in and take on that role, really. It could have easily all kind of ended in failure for Rafa, and he could have been cast out by Christmas. Instead, though, he's still put together a very good Napoli side that still play with that great aggression and intensity in their games, which I'm glad hasn't been lost by Napoli as they continue the season. And guess what, Raf? Guess what? Milan actually got a win last night in the Coppa Italia. Would you believe it? Against Spezia. Robinho, Pazzini and Honda scoring his first goal for the club in a 3-1 victory for AC Milan. Siena beating Catania as well last night. And there was Coppa del Rey action. Real Madrid down to 10 men against Osasuna, after Fabio Contrao was sent off in the 84th minute. But goals from Cristiano Ronaldo and Angel Di Maria meant that Madrid safely through to the next round of the Copa del Rey. And of course, Olympic Lyonnais taking on Marseille last night in the Coupe de la Ligue. We were talking about with Jonathan Johnson yesterday. And Lyon with that 2-1 win over Marseille. Troyes beating Evian and Nantes beating Nice in the Coupe de la Ligue. And it's very nice to see that the cup competitions, as we said yesterday, still being respected. Two strong sides put out by Marseille and Lyon last night for the Coupe de la Ligue. Brings me on to my point about tradition in cups. This is what I wanted to talk to you about, Raf. I know we've been talking about the FA Cup a fair bit recently, and obviously Manchester City's demolition of Blackburn showing that they continue to roar on in all competitions at the moment. Pellegrini saying he wants to see possibly a quadruple from his side. I don't think that could be possible this season, but we will see how City fare. They are, of course, an exquisite side going forward. Anyway, I digress. Talk today about the FA Cup finally having a sponsor. We all know that the Capital One Cup is the Capital One Cup and not the League Cup because it has a full-on sponsor. The FA Cup, in the meantime, has always maintained its name of the FA Cup, brought to you by AXA Insurance, or at the moment Budweiser. Budweiser not willing to renew their $9 million a year deal with the FA to sponsor the FA Cup anymore, and they're hopeful of getting another affiliate sponsor. But talk from the top at the FA is that this could potentially be turned into the insert sponsor who's willing to pay enough money here trophy. How much does that take?
Wanda.com trophy.
Oh my goodness. If that took place, nobody on earth wants to win the Wonga.com trophy.
I don't know. If it's enough Wonga for me, I would win it. I'm sorry.
You know, that's the oldest, most historic, most prestigious piece of silverware that you can win in football, Raf.
Well,
it's not the oldest, but one of the oldest.
Hey, let's not downplay the importance of the U.S. Open Cup now, one of the longest running competitions here in North America.
The soon to be called, you know, I don't know, Caesar's Palace Cup, as I'm sure it will take place as Major League Soccer and U.S. Soccer continues to be manipulated by sponsors, as does football everywhere else in the world. That is just the world we live in, unfortunately. But in all seriousness, though, it does take such tradition off it. I mean, the League Cup has already been spoilt, hasn't it, because we have to call it the well, we don't have to, but you know, we should call it things like the Coca-Cola Cup, the Capital One Cup, etc. It was once the Milk Cup. But the FA Cup has always been the FA Cup. And for it to be suddenly kind of bastardized by end up being called, like, you know, the Virgin Airways Cup, or yeah. I don't know, I'm trying to think of who else would sponsor it. I can only think of things like Wonga.com and
I was wondering, I was gonna ask you, is there any sponsor at all that would make it sound right? Or there's no kind of sponsorship whatsoever that would, even if it was the Umbro FA Cup.
No, because it won't be the Umbro FA Cup. It will be called the Umbro Cup. If it's not an affiliate sponsor, it will be called the Umbro Cup. It won't be the FA Cup in association with Umbro, as it is at the moment, the FA Cup in association with Budweiser, or the Budweiser-sponsored FA Cup. It's still the FA Cup. And if it gets turned into, you know, the Nike Cup, I mean, it takes away so much tradition from a tournament that is based so much of the cup magic is based on tradition of the FA Cup. I mean, the only way I think we could save it is if World Football Daily pulled our money together, we then sponsored it, and we decided to call it the FA Cup. I mean, that's what whoever sponsors it, if somebody does do that, should ensure that it remains the FA Cup, brought to you by full sponsor in here, and hopefully the FA can do that.
I mean, I don't want to, I'm just trying to look at the bigger picture here. Juice, isn't that where this game is going? I mean, look at
Sporting Direct. Of course,
it's... Look at Ibrox. Ibrox is potentially going to be bought out and renamed somewhere. And I don't think it'll ever be kind of called anything else by the fans.
Well, the only way, as I told you, is it needs to be sponsored by Apple, and then it can become Ibrox.
Yeah.
And that's the only way I think Rangers could save it. That's one which the sponsor could save it by it being Ibrox. But football is that way. We're so financially money orientated in football because it's a business now rather than just a game. But it still cuts deep every time something like this happens.
It's the same thing with Cardiff City changing from blue to red. I mean, I understand it. I get it. But at the same time, I think we as fans are almost to blame, because ultimately it comes down to the money being spent in this game and the fact that we want to see, we let the best players get these just obscene kind of contracts, and the money being spent in the game is just absolutely absurd these days. And we don't do anything about that. Well, so we just say, yeah, sure, pay these players because they're entertaining us.
Look what's happening with Neymar at the moment. Just sums up what world football is about at the moment. The £33.7 million payout to Neymar's father as part of the Brazilian's £47 million transfer fee is being investigated by Spanish state prosecutors for a misappropriation of funds. I mean, we've spoken about this Neymar kind of controversy around his transfer before, and it still kind of continues to blow on a bit around Barca. And obviously with state prosecutors looking into it as well, I don't think it could be an all-ending kind of career-deciding type factor to Neymar. But at the same time, it's obviously not great and shows how much A, money, and B, manipulation of money. When there's big money, there's always going to be corruption.
And C, you're never going to get something straight with a South American player deal, let's be real.
Yeah, it's... not that I want to put words in people's mouths, but, you know... You said it, Raph, not me. You said it, not me. But in all seriousness, though, I mean, it does. You know, whenever there's money, there's always corruption. You look at things like the betting scandals that are taking place in lower league football, because these betting companies can make so much money off it, and they're willing to pay somebody who's only maybe on, you know, £1,000 a week or something like that, less than that possibly, a lot less than that probably. When you're dealing in kind of conference and League Two players, you know, somebody who's getting paid very little, and somebody comes up and says, okay, give away six throw-ins or three corners in the first 20 minutes of the game, and we'll give you £50,000. And they're going to say, well, it probably won't affect too much, and I will take that £50,000. Thank you very much. It's a pretty big sum of money. It's always going to breed corruption whenever there's this amount of money in it. It's just a shame. Football's losing that romance. What would you want this FA Cup to be sponsored by? Let us know. Show at worldfootballdaily.com and at WFootballDaily on Twitter. 310-909-8483 is the rant line, the Facebook page as well. And also, what football story would you want made into a documentary? Would you want to see a kind of a digging up of the deals that were done to bring Cruyff or Pele to the NASL back in the day? Would you want to see the rise and fall of the NASL documented in an ESPN 30 for 30 or some sort of documentary like that? I'm sure it's been done before. Would you want to see it happen again? What would be the footballing stories that you want to see made into a 90-minute, say, documentary? Let us know. Show at worldfootballdaily.com and at WFootballDaily on Twitter. 310-909-8483 is the rant line in the Facebook page as well. We have bounced around a lot today in terms of getting into a bit of Southampton. I never thought we'd have Southampton dominating the headlines as much as they did in the early part of the show with Pochettino and the problems that are going on there. We've bounced into Germany.
I feel like the last time they kind of came up, they kind of imploded a bit and went back down. You know what I mean? It seems kind of cyclical for Southampton.
Yeah, but it all again stems to problems off the pitch that could very easily affect things on the pitch. And again, it sounds like, from what I've read, that Katharina Lieber wants to basically get more involved in the club that her father used to run, and it's somebody who is almost seeing the business opportunity of being a major big part player in a football team, rather than the footballing opportunity. And if it leads to Pochettino leaving Southampton, I think that will be a disaster for them. Absolute disaster. Quickly, one final question, Raph. We've only got a couple of minutes left. Who would you rather have as your strike force? Negredo and Aguero. Aguero taking 49 seconds to get back into the goals after coming on against Blackburn Rovers yesterday, or the SAS of Sturridge and Suarez right now?
I'm going with Negredo and Aguero. Particularly because I know for a fact that Aguero has proven himself in the Premiership, and that's not to say that Suarez hasn't. I've been watching Aguero more. I think that he is a very similar player to Suarez. Suarez could be better for all arguments here, but I think that I'm gonna go with Man City's striking pair. If you're going, no matter how you look at it, whether you're attaching the whole team to it, generally Man City are just going to walk all over Liverpool, position by position, and so
they didn't go at the Emirates. I mean, Liverpool were unlucky, weren't they?
They were, but I think even Man City have off days, and if you play that game 10 times. I think Man City probably blow out Liverpool 6-7 times out of that 10 time, kind of play. I'm sticking with Aguero. I like how he plays. He rises to the occasion, and he's not gonna, he hasn't done anything, Juice, that makes you worry, like he's a liability. Whereas, unfortunately, Suarez, there's always going to be that thing in the back of your mind, like, please don't blow up. Please don't do something stupid. Don't bite somebody.
Yeah, you're always worried.
What?
You're always worried about the guy's
temper. Well, you have to be, Juice. I mean, you have to be. And everybody kind of recognizes that. Everybody writes about it. People talk about, oh, he's so mature now. And, oh, he's got the captain's armband. He can step in for Stevie G anytime. That's not going to happen. I don't agree with that. He's not got the shoulders for that kind of pressure and that in that position.
Well, he hasn't shown the maturity and the responsibility to do it. I know he's been captain a couple of times for Liverpool, but I don't think he's shown the maturity and the responsibility in his career at Liverpool to do it on a full-time basis.
I do think that he would do just about anything to win.
Well, he would, wouldn't he? I mean, we've seen him do just about everything to try and win.
Just about everything. Whether you're going to bite somebody, whether you're going to give yourself a red card for a handball inside the box, trying to block a kick that definitely beat your keeper. I mean, on a World Cup stage, this guy will bend over backwards and give his team every opportunity to try to win. And I respect that. I do. I just think that because Aguero can do just about the same and stay on the pitch, I think he's a little bit more valuable.
We shall see who proves to be more valuable. Of course, Manchester City have Dzeko waiting in the wings as well. Aguero back and firing, as were Manchester City in general last night. A 5-0 win over Blackburn, stopping any doubters who thought there might be an FA Cup magical upset taking place there at the Etihad last night. And City continuing to bang in all the goals. If Grant Holt's the answer. What is the question at Aston Villa? That was thing. That, I think, was one of my favourite tweets that I read last night, as Villa rumoured to be bringing in Grant Holt as the transfer window continues. The mind boggles at that.
I'm so sorry. I'm not trying to be disruptive or anything like that, sir.
I had the same reaction when I saw that last night. And West Ham apparently looking to bring in Ricky Lambert for £7 million to revive their struggling Premier League season. And Igor Gundogan apparently not willing to commit to any sort of move to Manchester United just yet. Their troubles continue in the transfer window for United. We're going to leave it there for today. Remember, show at worldfootballdaily.com is where to find us at W Football Daily as well. Remember to check out Gio on the blog on worldfootballdaily.com as well as all the club podcasts.
Speaking of the blog, real quick, I'm sorry, there's a great little piece that I put up yesterday. It's regarding the newest boots from Puma, the Evo Power.
Nothing like tooting your own horn there, Raph, is it?
Yeah. Hey, I mean, if you're going to give a little Gio a little shout, I think I want a little bit of a shout.
All right,
so check out the latest Puma boots, the Puma Evo Powers. The likes of Cesc Fabregas, your boy Mario Balotelli, and Marco Reus have been wearing it for the past 2 weeks, kind of testing them out. And they should be open and available for purchase by the public tonight. So, yeah, check those out.
And Xavi may not be going to the New York Red Bulls, but will he be the landmark signing for New York City in a few years' time? We wait to see. It's a long wait for that transfer, I tell you, but those rumours already coming out from Major League Soccer. A big thanks to Andy Brassel, as always, for joining us here on the show today. A big thanks to you, Raph, and a huge thanks to you, the listener, who keep us running here at WFD. We will be back at the same time tomorrow to start previewing the weekend and get a little bit of IKTS going on as well. But until then, have a fantastic evening. Enjoy the football that's coming up tonight. And just very briefly, let me tell you what that football is coming up, because we do still have a little bit of Copa del Rey action. Villarreal take on Real Sociedad for the third time in 3 games, and Getafe take on Barca. Sociedad and Villarreal 0-0 after that first leg in the Copa del Rey. And Barcelona with a slight lead over Getafe after Lionel Messi's fantastic return and 2-goal brace last week. We'll keep up with them tomorrow, and we will catch up on all the games coming up this weekend. Until then, take care. Have a great night. We'll see you at 7 o'clock. Have a good one.